Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
Good morning and welcome everyone to our PCRF Research Forum podcast this morning. Thrilled to be joining you. We have all of our panelists here today, Tony Fernandez, Bill Toon, Jeff Rollman, myself, as well as the author for the exciting research that we're sharing today, Early Restrictive versus Liberal Oxygen for Trauma Patients, the TraumaOx Randomized Control Trial. This was published in JAMA. We'll put it in the chat here so that everybody can see it, but we're excited to bring you this hot off the press, fresh research for all of the researchers and budding paramedics and EMS providers that are out there today. As always, the research will be paired with an article that's published in EMS World. It's called Journal Watch. You can see this both online or in the latest edition of EMS World. So pick up a copy once you see it come out or view it online, as many do. Without any further ado, I want to dive right into it by introducing Dr. Tobias Arlith, our author today. He's going to share a little bit about his background and why he wanted to dive into this research. Welcome, Tobias.
Thank you very much, Michael. Yeah. So actually, as a medical student, I always kind of fancied trauma management and trauma treatment. And that's also where I began my research in other areas than oxygen. And actually, quickly after I graduated as a medical doctor back in January 2021, this project was developed among together with my supervisors, and there had been a lot of preparation work already done. So it was a sort of a plug and play project that I was really, really thrilled to be a part of. And look where we are today, publishing in JAMA. That's it's been a great experience for me to be a part of and to improve trauma care this way.
So, and not only were you doing this,
thank you for hosting.
Absolutely, not only were you doing this as part of medical school, but you were also doing this as part of your dissertation. Is that correct?
No, I had graduated as a medical doctor, so it was a full time PhD position. So we used to call it the TraumaOx 2 trial, and it's part of my PhD thesis. Yeah, the dissertation. So here in Copenhagen in Denmark. Yeah. And
We're thrilled for you to chat a little bit about it. Besides for the project was sort of ongoing and you got to join in on it, what got you excited about doing this type of research? And sort of walk us through the introduction as you see it and started taking on this project.
I think that the idea of including patients out on the street was a really, really challenging task and something that I wanted to be part of improving, because, I mean, the amount of intensive care unit trials, there are really, really a lot of them out there. But improving patient care already from when patients are suffering from trauma out on the street, that's quite rare, because it's actually really, really difficult. There's a lot going on out on the street, and that's why we got into it. We wanted to investigate this area as soon as the patients were traumatized. Because that's actually, I mean, the whole idea behind, the whole rationale for doing this study was the Advanced Trauma Life Support Guidelines, recommending that all severely injured trauma patients should always receive supplemental oxygen without any criteria for how much they should receive or what the aim of the saturation should be. And me and my research group had done some research before this trial to where we found out that the evidence behind this quite liberal recommendation in the ATLS guidelines was quite sparse. So we recommended that, or actually we told ourselves that we needed to conduct this trial because in other trial populations, such as in a patient suffering from acute myocardial infection, it has shown that it is definitely not beneficial and it is actually harmful to receive too much oxygen when suffering from acute myocardial infection. So we thought that maybe there was something similar in trauma. I mean, why should you receive a lot of oxygen if it maybe it's not necessary? And that's what we tried to investigate in this trial, and as soon as possible after trauma. That was the goal, and that was what we wanted to find out.
I think that's so interesting. Did you have any pre-hospital providers on your research committee or on your team?
Yeah, actually, the last author, who was also my main PhD supervisor, Jacob Steinmetz, he's an anesthesiologist, so he's a medical doctor. And while he can induce anesthesia in the hospital, a lot of the time he also works in the pre-hospital environment, both as a doctor in ambulance vehicles, but he's also a professor at the helicopter emergency medical service in Denmark. Because here in Denmark and in many places in Europe, we have doctors out on the street alongside paramedics, which I believe that in the US you do not have doctors, right?
Pretty limited if we do.
Yeah. So this has been Jacob's like one of his main focus of interest the last 10 years about oxygen and trauma. So I got along the way at a very good timing.
Nice. And maybe a little bit of a crash course in some of the EMS, which is even better. So we love to see EMS providers and those working in the pre-hospital setting, no matter their role on research. So just continue to involve EMS. I pulled the objective of your study. It's on the slide here. Do you want to walk us through what that is? And then Dr. Fernandez will walk us through a bit of the methods.
Yeah, so only the objective, right? Or
It's your podcast. You talk about whatever you want.
all right. So what we wanted to do was that we wanted to determine whether, and it was important for us that the oxygen interventions should start as soon as possible after trauma, because otherwise, if the patients, if they were only included like in the intensive care unit in the hospital, then there would be a lot of hours where the potential oxygen could kind of vary, like the variations between the groups would be too many hours before we began our intervention. So we deemed it necessary that it should start early, and we chose an 8 hour restrictive versus liberal oxygen strategy, and that's we the intervention that we thought was new was the restrictive one, because we thought that a liberal strategy was somehow the way that we defined it based on the ATLS guidelines. But I mean, the ATLS guidelines just say that you should provide supplemental oxygen to all severely injured trauma patients. And what we saw in observational study was that, I mean, severely injured trauma patients, they receive a lot of oxygen. And then it was important that it was in adult trauma patients, and we thought that this early 8 hour intervention of restrictive oxygen strategy would reduce a composite outcome of death and all major respiratory complications. And it was death within 30 days, and the major respiratory complications was defined as pneumonia. And also acute respiratory distress syndrome. So that's what we thought when going into this trial. And
That
yeah.
seems to pass my sniff test, Tony, that I feel like in most of the trauma patients that we see cared for and then the documentation we review and the patients coming to the hospital, if they're a trauma victim, they're coming in with oxygen. I know on the initial education side, every shock patient gets a high flow oxygen. So I guess it, in my mind, that passes my sniff test that we're probably doing the same thing here as well.
I want to thank you for joining us today. This is a really cool study, and I think there's a lot of real nuance that you put into this study that made it such a high-level study and able to be published in JAMA. So I'm really excited to talk to you about your methods today. So let's start off, and we'll just start with what the study's setting was. And I love your first sentence of your methods because there's a lot to unpack just in this first sentence. So the Trauma Ox study was an investigator-initiated, pragmatic, international, multicenter, open label, parallel group, superiority, primary outcome, assessor-blinded, randomized control trial. And that, boy, that says a lot. But it goes to how intricate this study was. So can you help us unpack this a little bit and tell us a little bit about your study and how this was initially put together from about a 30,000 foot view?
Yeah. So the important thing for us, first and foremost, was that it was a randomized trial, meaning that when patients were included, we would have a randomization table. And then doctors out on the street or in the trauma center, they would either pick an envelope stating that the patient should receive a restrictive oxygen strategy or receive a liberal oxygen strategy. And this is important to get evenly balanced groups when since patients are all different. But when doing this, just doing different interventions just by chance, when you do this enough times, then just by chance, patients should be evenly distributed between the two groups. And that is super, super important when you want to investigate the effect of an intervention. So that was the absolute bare minimum. And then we wanted this trial to have a potentially huge impact. And you do not do that only in one trial center. So we wanted it to be an international trial out across borders. And we wanted it to be at only high or major trauma centers. So all trauma centers should actually be able to provide definitive treatment care. And then it was also, like you said, Tony, it was a superiority trial. And that means that what we were trying to investigate was that the hypothesis was that a restrictive oxygen strategy, when comparing it to a liberal one, was that the restrictive was superior to a liberal oxygen strategy. And that's important to bear in mind also when I get back to the results later on and the conclusion that it was designed as a superiority trial because we were seeing if a restrictive was better than a liberal oxygen strategy. Did I miss anyone?
Yeah,
Yeah,
no, and I'm
yeah.
glad you, please. No, I was just gonna say I'm glad you dove into the superiority part because a lot of studies that we'll review will just be looking for a difference. And you specifically were looking at if one was better than the other, which does have some important implications in your analysis and your results.
Yeah. And then also stating that it was open label, that's also quite important because normally what you want to do, the gold standard in randomized controlled trials is that you blind the interventions, both for patients but also for healthcare professionals, so that the intervention does not bias the healthcare providers in doing either better or worse treatment based on their own perception of what they think of the intervention. But as some of you might know, masking oxygen intervention. That's really, really, really difficult. And especially when you do a trial like ours, where we included patients at 15 different pre-hospital bases, meaning both vehicles and also helicopters. And also this 8-hour intervention had to follow the patient in the hospital and then in whatever department the patient landed in, which could be the intensive care unit or any other ward. And if you would have to do to mask that sort of intervention all the way through that, I mean, I if anyone has a great idea of how to do that, I would be happy to hear it.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that either. I think you did. You made way more than lemonade with what you had here. This is a really interesting, really great study.
Just took me off if I talk too much. Sorry.
No, you can't talk too much for this group. So your study period was December 7th, 2021 to September 12th, 2023, and what was I think really interesting and had to be pretty challenging for your providers was your consent process, how you got patients to agree to participate in this study, because a lot of times they were unable to provide you with informed consent when you wanted to enroll them in the study, because these are trauma patients. Can you talk to us a little bit about that consent process and how you were actually able to get these folks enrolled?
Yeah. So the rules in at least in Denmark initially, so when my supervisor and my research group before I came along did the pilot trial of this, there was a lot of debate in the research ethics committee in Denmark on how to do this, because we as doctors, healthcare providers, we would probably say that almost all of these patients, depending on, of course, if you're unconscious, then of course you cannot be asked, but also even mild trauma, I mean, that because of just the trauma itself, you cannot just put out some papers and tell them everything about the study and if they want to participate. So after a lot of going back and forth with the research ethics committee, they originally allowed us to simply think of every patient, no matter what, not being able to consent initially. So we had to ask another doctor if it was okay to enroll this patient with the knowledge that we had at that time. And then afterwards, when the patient became himself or herself, or woke up from coma or something like that, and when we thought it was reasonable to ask the patient for consent, then that's what we did. So we described the situation for them, that we had enrolled them in a study because another one told us that it was okay, and that was okay with the research ethics committee. And it was actually in some of the other countries, in the Netherlands and in Switzerland, it was a little bit different, because the law there stated that actually you could just enroll patients without asking anyone, because the research ethics committee had said that it was, if we could not do trials like this, we would never be able to do trials on acute care patients. And actually the law has just been changed in Denmark as well, because now we run an EU law. So it's a bit challenging. But luckily we almost everyone said yes when we came and asked them afterwards.
That's great. And yeah, I just want to highlight how complex and difficult this had to be, because this was an international study. So, you know, a lot of times we review studies that are done here in the States, and by and large, they run on the same rules. But I'll tell you what, having to deal with different countries and different rules and to collate all of your results the way you did, that's a lot of work. And I really appreciate you doing it, because I think this is a really important addition to the literature. So let's go ahead and talk about your patients, who you enrolled. So your inclusion criteria, you had patients 18 years or older, of childbearing age, they experienced blunt or penetrating trauma. And I think what was important was that they had to be transported directly to a trauma center, and have a full trauma team activation triggered, and the enrolling physician had to anticipate a hospital stay of at least 24 hours. Can you talk to us a little bit about the 24-hour length of stay and why you thought that was important for the inclusion criteria here?
Yeah, so that was actually the most sort of say the most annoying thing when initiating the trial was that I just had so many calls from doctors asking me how should I interpret this inclusion criterion, because it is quite vague. I mean, when do I expect a trauma patient to be hospitalized for 24 hours? Sometimes you're not in doubt, but really often you are, because doctors do not have x-ray out on the street. And someone who looks pretty okay might have a huge hemorrhage in the abdomen. But it was because we wanted to have a trial population reflecting severely injured trauma patients. And that's why we chose this 24-hour hospitalization expectation. Because what we could have done instead was ask all the physicians who included the patients that they should follow some sort of severity algorithm. But thinking about all the stress out on the street, it was even difficult already with the inclusion criteria as we had them to enroll severely injured trauma patients. So it was simply to enhance enrollment, to have it as vague as possible like that, but still maintaining some sort of severity in the trial population.
Yeah, and I'd imagine the time that it took for you to come to that decision was not trivial. I'm sure you went back and forth with a lot of options there. So again, there's so much work went into this study, and I appreciate you doing it. Exclusion criteria, you excluded carbon monoxide and cardiac arrests. And then if within a secondary survey, you found out that they had minor injuries or they weren't expected to be admitted or they were discharged within 24 hours, they were excluded post-randomization as well. But speaking of randomization, you had a really sophisticated randomization where you had a one-to-one assignment with variable block sizes. Can you, this was not your just regular, let's produce a random number generator and assign patients that way. Can you talk to us about how you did some of your randomization?
Yeah, so we had a statistician, he had some colleagues to do the randomization tables for us, so he remained completely blinded. But what we did was that at all pre-hospital bases and all the trauma centers, we had envelopes that were either white or black, and you had to it was white if the patient was not intubated, and it was black if the patient was intubated. And then actually it's a bit detailed, but that's actually two different randomization tables going into either a white or a black one. And then also there was a specific table for each pre-hospital base or trauma center. And that's important that you have, at least that's what we thought, that we have specific randomization table for each site and each base, because otherwise there's also a risk if you only have one big randomization table where you just go 1-2, 1-2, 1-2 in these different block types. There would be a risk that a lot of, let's say, the liberal oxygen strategy randomization interventions would end up in the Netherlands, and a lot of the restrictive one would end up in Denmark. But by doing this stratification, as it's called, when we stratify on the base and on whether they're intubated at randomization, we make sure that the liberal and oxygen, the liberal and the restrictive groups were quite evenly distributed among all the sites.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. And you caught me in the middle of a cough there, but I appreciate. So let's talk about your groups. So you randomized into the restrictive group and the liberal group. And we talked a little bit about this before, but can you kind of dive in? And what was the difference between the two randomization groups? What did the restrictive group get in terms of their oxygen therapy? And what did the liberal group, what were they allowed?
Yeah, so what we did was in the restrictive group, there was a saturation target, and the saturation was based on the peripheral saturation on a pulse oximeter, on the finger. And if the saturation was below 94%, patients should receive supplemental oxygen, either via a nasal cannula, a non-rebreather mask, or mechanical ventilation if the patient was unconscious. But you should only go as high as trying to achieve a saturation of 94%. But we found out quite quickly that sometimes, I mean, the saturation goes up and down. So the aim was 94, but if you would turn up 1 liter of oxygen versus zero and it came up to 95 instead of being at 91, then that was also okay. And in the liberal oxygen group, if the patients were not intubated, they should initially have 15 liters of oxygen per minute pre-hospitally and in the trauma resuscitation room. But once going to a ward or the intensive care unit, if the patients would saturate at least 98%, you were allowed to reduce it to 12 liters. And if the patient was unconscious and was ventilated mechanically with a ventilator, they should initially start on 100% of a fraction of inspired oxygen. But for the non-intubated patient, there was also this possibility to reduce the oxygen exposure to 60% if they could at least saturate 98%. And that's how it came along for the 8 hours. And then we did two arterial blood gases, one at hour one, plus minus 30 minutes, and also another one at 6 hours, plus minus 2 hours, to look for the adherence to the interventions in terms of arterial blood gas analysis.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Perfect. And so then let's talk to what you were actually looking for, right? So your outcomes. You had a composite outcome where you combined death and or major respiratory complications within 30 days. And your major respiratory complications were, correct me if I'm wrong, you had pneumonia based on the CDC definition and acute respiratory distress based on the Berlin definition. Those were your two complications. And then, of course, death. And you combine those into one outcome. So did they experience either or? And then secondarily, you looked at those separately, right? So you looked specifically at death and respiratory complications within 30 days. Does that capture your outcomes appropriately?
Completely. Yep.
Yep.
All right.
Awesome. And then what I thought and what is really important in a lot of these clinical trials or you looked at an independent safety and data monitoring committee looked at your data at two specific points. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that was needed and what they did?
Yeah, so it is needed because when you run a big trial like this, if you were only to include 50 patients, it's not necessary to have external people looking at your data because 50 patients is not a lot, but when you but 1420 patients, let's say that at if we had back then when we had enrolled about 25 patients, if you would see a clear effect of either a restrictive or liberal oxygen strategy in terms of reducing or increasing death, it would be highly unethical to continue the trial. So that's why you need these two stops at called interim analysis, where you have, I mean, we did not look at the data. You take out the data being completely blinded, and then you pass it on to a statistician and some other very clever people who look at the data, and they make a report and state whether they think the trial should go on. And it's almost always for safety reasons for the patients. That's the main idea behind it, and that's
absolutely
also what they advised us to continue the trials at both interim stops at 25% and 50% of the enrollment of the patients.
Yep, that's so important, and thank you for diving into that. Now, if it were up to me, I could talk to you about methods for the entire hour. But our audience certainly would love to get to some of your really interesting results. So before I do open it up to the results section, I want to give our other panelists an opportunity to ask some methods related questions. And again, I wanted to thank you for publishing the study and for talking to us about it today. I think this is really great work.
Thank you.
Jeff or Bill, any thoughts on the methods?
Nope.
Okay, then I think it's time to dive into the results. Dr. Arleth, do you want to just talk us through it? I did pull your table. So here's table one, which does a nice job of sort of walking through the patient populations and where they ended up in their, you know, treatment algorithm.
Yeah. So first and foremost, it's important to notice that the 5,441 that were assessed in the trauma center, I mean, we did actually include patients, of course, in the street, but trying to, if it, I mean, some people here know how it's like working in on the street, and that is just extremely difficult to get those numbers. And Yama was okay with us reporting the numbers like this. And then, of course, we had a lot of patients who were excluded. And then we ended up randomizing actually 1,979, meaning that someone took an envelope on the 1,979. And they were randomized into a restrictive and a liberal oxygen group. And when running an acute trial like ours, it is sometimes difficult to be sure that all the right patients are included in the trial. And that's if we go down to the excluded after randomization numbers, that's 59 in the restrictive group and 71 in the liberal group. Those were actually reasons. Normally you would say that you do not exclude patients after randomizations. But we did this because some of these patients are included at two in the night, at 2 o'clock in the night, by a physician who cannot really see on an unconscious patient whether the patient might be 17 or might be 18. And then we were quite direct in that we think patients should then be included if they otherwise fulfill the inclusion criteria. But those were patients where we got to know these reasons shortly after randomization. So the amount of time they were actually in the trial was quite limited. And that's why we pulled them out of the study. And then we have the 174 secondary exclusions and 165 in the restrictive and liberal oxygen group. And we have had to defend this for a lot of people because, again, excluding patients after randomization is not the gold standard. But as I said about the inclusion criterion of 24 hours expectation of hospitalization, this secondary exclusion criteria where patients were excluded if the secondary survey revealed no or minor injuries and expected discharge within 24 hours was also to maintain a severely injured trauma population. And the reason for why at least that's what we think, is that the reason for why JAMA actually also thought that this was okay is because when you pre-specify a decision like this, both in the protocol that we published before enrollment of the last patient, it was written before enrollment of the first, but it was published alongside the trial while it was running. But also in our statistical analysis plan that was also published, when you are completely transparent on how you want to do it, that is just important for getting out with important research. And then we have 750 and 758 in the two groups. And as you can see, there are actually double as many in the liberal oxygen group who do not want to consent afterwards when they wake up, or we believe that they are conscious enough to receive the information. And that's, of course, a bit unlucky that double as many in the liberal group did not consent. You could argue that possibly some patients find it rather uncomfortable lying there with a mask, because a few of them was actually asked in the intervention period because they were quite conscious. And then we ended up with 733 and 724 in the primary analysis. So there's a lot of work in the graph.
But I think it's so helpful for our audience members to understand what goes into setting up a trial like this, right? We haven't even gotten to the results in yet. We're still trying to make sure that the right buckets are filled with the right patients and sticking to those inclusion criteria so strictly. That's what makes the results mean so much. And I think our audience appreciates sort of hearing how you went through that process. Now that we have our patients in the right treatment groups, we can start to compare their demographics as well as start to look at what happened to them after their 8 hours of treatment.
Yeah. So what we see here in this slide is the demographics. And I want to, instead of running through it all, I want to highlight a few demographics between the two groups. So what you see in the top is that the median age in both groups is around 50. And when you go down and look at the sex, it's mostly males who get traumatized. And normally, I mean, since this is a randomized trial where we have put up envelopes, you do not make any statistical tests to see if the two groups are different, because if they are different, then it's just a coincidence. Then we cannot do anything about it. And actually, the proportion of active smokers look fairly different from each other, because it's 27% is the restrictive group and 34% the liberal oxygen group. Even though it's about 1500 patients in total. And then I want to highlight that the proportions of patients intubated and randomization was actually 24% approximately in both groups, which is actually quite good, I think. Because this was also one of the factors that we stratified on. So we picked up an envelope. We picked different envelopes based on the randomization, the intubation status. So if this number would only have been 5% maybe, then it was probably not that important, but actually was a good proportion of the patients. Because we do believe that, I mean, being intubated does affect the outcome when doing different oxygen interventions. And then also the site of inclusion, where we have approximately 60% included in hospital and about 40% included pre-hospital. That's also something that we're quite proud of, because I mean, 40% out on the street, in the helicopter, in the vehicle, under really adverse and time critical conditions, that's actually quite good. So we strive for the most what can you say, the most sort of correct outcomes based on not polluting our data with other oxygen being provided before the randomization. So a lot of them was pre-hospitally. And then I have one final thing I want to highlight, the injury severity score, actually on the right column, and the EEISS median. You usually say that an injury severity score above 15 is severely injured, and it is a median of 14 in both groups. So it's just, I mean, the trauma population is moderately to severely injured, because the 75% percentile in the parentheses is 22. So there are definitely some patients who are quite severely injured. And so, I mean, and that's even when, remember back to the inclusion criteria, where all patients had to have doctors expecting them to be there for 24 hours. And we have even also excluded patients in the trauma resuscitation room who, after a CT scan, did not have any injuries. And that kind of gets you to think that it's quite difficult to get a completely really really severely injured group, because the focus is not 100% on research. Yeah, so I
Absolutely.
think that's some of the highlights. And actually also in the bottom, which about the arterial blood gases during the intervention, this highlights for that actually both groups were really different from each other in terms of the partial pressure of arterial oxygen in the blood at hour one and also at hour six. As you can see, the millimeters of mercury are so different from each other. So the patients were definitely receiving different oxygen interventions, that's for sure.
And you can tell me if this is a correct understanding or not, but in my mind, that demonstrates that there's actually something to look at here, right? There is some physiology associated with these higher oxygenation rates. So, like, this could actually be driving some outcomes. So, I'd like to see that difference when we get to the oxygenation. I think when you mentioned the ISS scores, I was like, the research, we really want sick trauma victims, though there's not as many of those coming in the doors as we sometimes expect, which goes to speak to the great way that they build cars and roadway safety and helmets for bicycles and things like that. So, despite our research wanting really sick patients, those patients aren't coming through the doors, as often as maybe it would benefit our research. So, the things we want and the things we get are sometimes separate. So, let me get into the results, the continued results here as we start to look at patient outcomes.
Yeah, so the most important outcome, of course, the primary outcome, which was this composite of death and or major respiratory complications. And bear in mind that it's in the caption that we don't see here, it's within 30 days. In the restrictive oxygen group, the proportion was 16.1%, and in the liberal oxygen group, the proportion was 16.7%. And that gave us an odds ratio of 1.01. But when you look at the 95% confidence intervals, it could also go as low as 0.75 or as high as 1.37. So actually, it's quite symmetrical around 1.00, which would be like identical results. And bear in mind that, like Tony said earlier, this primary outcome event was either if death occurred or if there was a major respiratory complication, and each patient could only count for one here. But when you look at them individually, actually there was a higher proportion of death in the restrictive oxygen group compared to the liberal one, but bear in mind that it is not statistically significant, because you can actually tell by looking at the 95% confidence interval. Because it goes, if you look out at the odds ratio, which we used odds ratios mainly, it is 1.28, meaning a higher risk of death, because if the estimate is higher than 1.00, it is increased risk of death, and if it's below, then it decreases. But since this estimate is the 95% confidence intervals are from 0.85 to 1.92, meaning that 1.00 is in this interval, then you can actually state just by looking at that confidence interval that it is not statistically significantly different from each other. So it could just be due to chance. But looking at major respiratory complications, it's actually the opposite picture. And that causes headaches for researchers. That one important estimate goes in one direction and another important estimate goes in the other direction. And because then what do you want to do? Because of course you want to avoid death. But it could be due to chance. So it looks like based on these results that maybe death is a bit increased, but on the other hand, major respiratory complications are decreased with a restrictive group. But none of it is statistically significantly. So. And regarding some of the exploratory outcomes, we looked at hypoxemic episodes, ICU readmission, sepsis, surgical site infection. And you can actually see out in on the right of the graph that you there is this, it's a little bit hard to see here, but in the middle there's a line, and the square bracket actually represents the estimate, and then the lines around it represent the 95% confidence interval. And as you can see, it looks like that ICU readmission, sepsis, and surgical site infection favors a restrictive group. But on the other hand, hypoxemic episodes and pneumonia post-discharge might favor a little more to the liberal one. But it's important to bear in mind that since it is stated exploratory outcomes, what we did was that we actually adjusted for something called multiple testing. Because if you just run a statistical test over and over again, then there is a possibility that it may become significant just by chance. And we did that with all the exploratory outcomes. So even though that surgical site infection in the 95% confidence interval does not have 0.00 in the middle, meaning that it is statistically significant, then after the adjustments, the statistical adjustments for multiple testing, none of these results were actually statistically significant between the groups. So there, throughout the entire trial, we did not find any differences that were statistically significant.
As the researcher looking at these numbers, as they're coming across for you and the team to evaluate, what's going through your mind, right? At this point in time, we're looking at the data because the trial's concluded, and we're seeing that there's no statistical significance. Put us in your mind at that point in time and sort of what was the discussion amongst the researchers? What are you thinking when you're seeing this?
Well, for the first, I won't lie, for the first 2 seconds, you think, the hypothesis was that restrictive was superior. And based on these data, that's far from the truth. And then after the 2 seconds where you stop thinking about that, then you just think, okay, this really adds to the evidence in this area, because the main problem with this research area was that there was actually no evidence. But now it seems like based on these data that actually maybe it doesn't really matter much whether you give a restrictive or a liberal oxygen strategy to these patients. And that's actually really, really important knowledge. Because right now we give a lot of oxygen to these patients because of the recommendation from the ATLS guidelines. And at least what I hear from many of my colleagues is that oxygen is sort of not treated 100% the same way as many other medical drugs, because there is a way of thinking maybe that it's a little less harmless than many other medical drugs. But again, I mean, why it is a medical drug, but I mean, based on these data, why should you provide a drug that do not look to affect outcomes based on providing less of it. That was kind of some of the things that we went through in our heads.
That's so interesting, and I think profound in the fact that there aren't a whole lot of other drugs that we give prophylactically because we think there's no harm, so we might as well give them. And we have that conversation with our EMT and our paramedic students all the time of very rarely is there something you just give the patient hoping that it helps. Now we're actually starting to look at some evidence to say that, gosh, maybe it's not as beneficial as we want. I want to get onto the rest of your tables and figures, but I think that I appreciate you sharing that about the research group and what you were thinking, because I do think it's sometimes we jump right past the actually there is a lot of value in this, even if it doesn't prove exactly what we were setting out to prove. So I can appreciate that for sure.
And it's just important to remain objective to your results. I mean, it's so easy to get biased towards your hypothesis and being a bit sad. Oh, I was not right on my hypothesis. But I mean, the data is data, and that's really important to maintain that idea when doing research. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I think there's a value in being a research purist and going where the data takes you. I want to loop into, because William asked a really good question here, and you had stratified in your results for head injury patients specifically, and that's what he asked about was, in the some of the EPIC trials that were done here in the US looking at well oxygenating those patients that are suffering from a brain injury. Do you have any thoughts on this compared to what the treatment is specific for a head injury type patient, where we try and prevent those hypoxic moments, taking into effect that on the last slide we saw that there were some hypoxic incidents with our restrictive group?
Yeah, but it's actually really interesting because we had a lot of discussions also after we initiated the trial with our neuro intensive care units, because they were really feeling that we did harm to our patients with the restrictive oxygen group. Whereas other intensivists, being in the general intensive care unit, they thought that we did harm by doing the liberal oxygen group. But what we thought about was that we try to stay true to the ATLS guidelines, because they do not differ on injury type. But on the other hand, I do acknowledge that, of course, you cannot directly compare a traumatic brain injury patient to an abdominal injury patient. They are different. But the problem was that there was no evidence on this topic. So we have just started out with a heterogeneous trauma population. And now we've kind of just dipped our feet in the great ocean, and now it's time to make more individualized trials, looking at specifically what about the TBI patients, the traumatic brain injury patients, what about the chest trauma patients. And I have a PhD fellow colleague who is doing a lot of follow-up on our patients here. And she's actually looking specifically on TBI patients, on a nested sub trial of all of the TBI patients in the TrauMAX2 trial, to see if there is a difference in these two groups when only looking at those two. Because right now in these data, we have just pooled all things. We've just pooled all the injury types. But yeah, so.
I think that's really interesting and goes back to your results that had the arterial oxygen saturations, where again, there is an indicator here that this could have a physiologic implication. So now looking a little bit more specific at what the subgroups were to see if there's a difference. Yeah. I'm very interested to see what that comes in. Jeff is joining us as well, and I think he has a question.
Yeah, just wanted to jump in and first off, just say thank you for joining us today. I know it's definitely much later in the day, nighttime probably in Denmark. But super impressive to read about what you're doing. And I saw that you published your supplement, over 100 pages of your detailed protocol, very carefully done. I mean, we're looking at the final product, but a ton of careful thought that went into this. And going back to that figure two, that patient outcomes, I really liked how you looked at some of the other exploratory outcomes, because I can only imagine, I mean, very disappointing to not see significant differences with the primary and secondary outcomes, but that you also looked at some other outcomes. And yes, you did the multiple comparisons adjustment, so you weren't just looking around, diving for other results. But I thought that this was really interesting in terms of thinking about what's next. So it seems like it passes the sniff test, kind of, that favors liberal oxygen strategy for we're going to see less likelihood of hypoxemic episodes if we're blasting everybody with oxygen, but that if we're much more careful, maybe not statistical significance, but we're seeing better potential outcomes with some of those other items. I was wondering what this makes you think in terms of what's next. I know you mentioned about your postdoc is working on TBI, but does this make you think that maybe we shouldn't just be looking at death, but potentially other outcomes? If we could power the study appropriately, maybe we'd find something else. So thank you again, and curious your thoughts on where we go from here.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jeff. It's a good question. I mean, when thinking about that some major oxygen trials, as maybe someone here has heard of the SAVO2 trial, that has just been published in JAMA Open, with 12,000 patients, and then also the MEGAROCKS trial in the intensive care unit with 40,000 patients. It would be really great to make a trial like this, but just bigger, because I mean, I could be a little concerned that because oxygen is really cheap and it's easy to use, that maybe we just have too few patients here. And because it's cheap and it's easy to use, then even small group differences of 1 to 2%, that in, I mean, in outcomes such as major respiratory complications and death, is extremely important because it's cheap. So I mean, doing some sort of the same trials but just bigger, that would be definitely one of my dreams. But maybe choosing another outcome in a different way that how we did the major respiratory complications would be necessary, because it was really a lot of work having assessors going through all the medical records and doing a blinded review of whether the patient had a respiratory complication. That was an insane amount of work and not super objective all the time. Because the assessors were often disagreeing, and then they had to come to an agreement. And maybe something like ventilator-free days within 30 days is more objective, if it's only mechanical ventilation patients, for example. That could be a better way of doing it. But I also want to highlight, remember that I said in the start that we designed this as a superiority trial, meaning that the restrictive oxygen group was, we were looking for if it was better than a liberal oxygen group. And based on these data, we cannot say that it is better. So you cannot leave this podcast thinking, oh, the restrictive group is better. Not at all. But on the other hand, you cannot say that it's worse either. But right now they just look a little similar. So it depends on how you read the numbers, and that's why it's not easy to interpret, because the key secondary outcomes go in both in opposite directions, which creates a headache on how you want to go from here.
Well, we greatly appreciate you going through the trial, through the data, experiencing the headaches that come with this great data analysis, Dr. Arleth. We're so incredibly happy and thankful that you joined our podcast to share a little bit about it. And I think that was actually a great summary of what the trial left us with and where we go from here in terms of looking at future research. So I always get myself or Dr. Crow always get the bad news of saying, and we're wrapping up for the last hour here. But thank you so much, Dr. Arleth, for joining us today and sharing sharing a little bit about your research. For those of you interested in our next upcoming podcast, it'll be our educational podcast on Friday, April 25th. We're looking at simulation versus clinical experience for paramedic training. And our next clinical podcast is Monday, May 12th. And this podcast is going to look at the some agitation scale use in pre-hospital medicine. So thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you at our next podcast.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.